Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty. We've got a great program planned for you today, and we are so glad you have joined us for it again. One quick thing that we want to make you aware of is that this program is a rebroadcast discussing my book, Restoring America's Soul. Now, I wrote the book when I was still Rita Dunaway, but don't let that throw you. It's still me, and I hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and we're continuing our journey through Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. We're focusing today on the big challenge of what she calls putting big government back in its place. And I have to think of David when I hear that title. When he went up against Goliath, it is the same way. How are we going to put big government back in its place? Well, we'll see what happens in just a minute, because Rita's going to break that down for us. But before we begin, let's take a quick look at our earlier programs to provide some background for today's topic. To begin, Rita emphasized that as conservatives, we should focus on what we are for, that is, we are for limited government in this case, rather than just what we are against. We want to conserve from our rich heritage all that is good. We also talked about the importance of tone and civility in our debates, especially on the hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. That also means that we need to listen to each other respectfully. Then we moved on to the importance of making decisions on what we know to be true and good, rather than on our feelings, which often get us into trouble by telling us, if it feels good, do it. Then we look back at how our conservative principles grew out of our Judeo-Christian heritage and how they helped our founding fathers create the constitutional system of limited government. And then we started looking at contrasts between liberals and conservatives. For example, who does a better job of caring for the poor, liberals or conservatives? The answer was surprising. And that took us into some really hot-button issues that involve our religious freedoms. For example, when gay rights activists challenge our rights of conscience not to participate in same-sex wedding celebrations, who wins? Then there's a similar debate about competing rights between an unborn baby's right to life and the mother's right to choose whether her doctor should destroy that unborn child. In that case, again, who decides? Finally, last week, we took on another hot-button issue in talking about the case for natural marriage, and it comes against a backdrop of decline in the institution of marriage. Because over time, it has become optional through cohabitation before marriage, disposable through easy divorce, and now even redefinable through same-sex marriage. And in all of this, we ask ourselves, what has happened to virtue in our culture, to integrity in our government, and what can we do to bring them back? That is our topic for today and for next week. But just one more thing now before we begin. Rita's chomping at the bit. She's ready to go. And I know some of our listeners may still be asking, who is Rita Dunaway and what qualifies her to take on this task of restoring America's soul? Well, that's a good question. For starters, she's a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University, Washington and Lee University School of Law. She also worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute, as an allied attorney for Alliance Defending Freedom, and now as national legislative strategist for the Convention of States Project. Well, that's a long line, Rita. We got a big subject ahead of us. How do you respond to this idea that our government is out of control?
Well, Dean, I think that is actually pretty obvious to most people at this point. But to lay the groundwork for this whole chapter, I'd like to share a little bit of my story, as I also do in this chapter of the book. I took my first course in constitutional law as an undergraduate political science student. And throughout that semester, I wondered sometimes if I was somehow missing something that was essential to understanding the Constitution. Now, I did well in the class, But I simply could not grasp the connection between the original text that I read in the Constitution, on the one hand, and our actual federal government that I read about in the newspaper every day, on the other hand. How could a government that was granted so few powers in the Constitution have such incredible authority over every aspect of its citizens' lives? And just to make sure we've all got the picture on this, I want to read this excerpt from Mark Levin's book called The Liberty Amendments. And it's a sort of a long excerpt, but he does lay the foundation for this so well, I think it's worth sharing. Here's what he says. What was to be a relatively innocuous federal government, operating from a defined enumeration of specific grants of power, has become an ever-present and unaccountable force. He's talking about the federal government, Dean. He goes on. It is the nation's largest creditor, lender, employer, consumer, contractor, grantor, property owner, tenant, insurer, health care provider, and pension guarantor. Moreover, with aggrandized police powers, what it does not control directly, it bans or mandates by regulation. Then he continues by giving examples. For example, the federal government regulates most things in your bathroom, laundry room and kitchen, as well as the mortgages you hold on your house. It designs your automobile and dictates the kind of fuel it uses. It regulates your baby's toys, crib, and stroller, plans your children's school curriculum and lunch menu, and administers their student loans in college. Indeed, the question is not what the federal government regulates, but what it does not. And it makes you wonder, how can a people incapable of selecting their own light bulbs and toilets possess enough competence to vote for their own rules and fill out complicated tax returns? Again, that's Mark Levin from his book, Liberty Amendments. And I don't know what tells the story of where we are better than that.
Right. Well, there's no question that the federal government today is doing much more than just exercising the powers it was specifically given in the Constitution. And that's a fact. That's not opinion. You know, Scripture comes into all of this, every topic that we discussed. And in this case, Jesus said something I think very profound when he was asked about taxation. He told his disciples, "Render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's?" And that seems to be reversed today when Caesar demands that we do things even that God has forbidden, and also suggests that we should give almost everything to Caesar with very little left to God. But it's about more than money. It's about power and authority. And that's what you're getting at when you talk about big government being out of control. And I think we also need to make very clear that the powers our government is given are very limited, and it's stated very clearly in the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. Powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively and to the people. The federal government has limited powers.
That's right. So it's really simple. If a power isn't stated in the Constitution that it's given to the federal government doesn't have the power. So, Dean, my puzzlement about this state of affairs persisted through law school, where the overwhelming majority of my studies were dedicated to reading and dissecting judges' interpretations of the Constitution and other laws, not to reading and understanding the primary law, the Constitution or statutes themselves.
Well, it's no wonder we have the judges that we have today, Rita, because this approach follows the modern trend of basing decisions not on the Constitution's text and its meaning when it was written, but rather on the latest view of constitutional meaning, as expressed, as I said, in many recent court cases. But there's a term for that.
Stare decisis.
And what does that mean? mean?
Well, it comes from the Latin, and it means that courts are bound to follow legal precedents that have been set by previous decisions.
Well, a good example of that, and I think you give it in your book, when a home builder cuts rafters for the roof of his house, he first cuts a pattern, and then he uses that pattern for all of the other rafters that follow. But if he instead uses each new rafter as the pattern for the next one, his last rafter is going to be quite different in length from the original pattern. And that's the problem of our courts today, cutting rafters against the wrong pattern.
Exactly. And another example, Dean, is the childhood game of telephone that most of us played as children where, you know, one person starts with a certain message at one end of the line, and each child then shares the message down the line. And by the time you get to the end, the message is totally different. Well, that is what has happened, in a sense, with our Constitution over the years. These modern court interpretations of the Constitution have stretched the meaning of the text to the point of absurdity, to the point where no average American could possibly tell you, even after a careful reading of the Constitution, what it will be deemed to permit or forbid. The functional application of the Constitution has been divorced from its text. And probably the best example of this is the explosion of constitutional so-called rights of privacy. Mentioned nowhere in our Constitution, such rights were allegedly discovered there by the Supreme Court back in the 60s and used at that time to preclude the states from regulating contraceptives. Now, today, these very same rights of privacy are said to dictate whether and how states can prohibit abortion, among other things. So you see the stretching there and how these rights invented by the courts from their reading of the Constitution change over time. And this is just one example of a trend that has been playing out for decades now. Other examples would include the bizarre way that the Commerce Clause is interpreted today to give Congress power over almost anything and everything that has the slightest effect on commerce. Think back to the Mark Levin quote about light bulbs and toilets. Think about the way the General Welfare Clause is now interpreted to give Congress the power to tax and spend for whatever it thinks is a good idea. In short, our nation has become unmoored from its textual anchor. Now, we know that there are some citizens today, those who like the trend towards socialism, who are pleased with this. But the question is, are the rest of us willing to entrust the future of our society to whatever persons or parties manage to rise to power and whatever judges decide the law should be?
Well, Rita, that reminds me of a text from Jeremiah. In this case, it applies to church leaders, but it could apply to government leaders as well. When he condemns the prophets for lying and he condemns the priests for making up their own rules. And he goes on to say that some people may even like it that way, as you just suggested, because they benefit from it, even though it strays from God's teaching or the Constitution about what should be done. And that doesn't sound like the rule of civil law or of God's law either, for that matter, and it's not the way it should be in America. But is there a solution?
I'm so glad you asked, and that's really
I'm on the edge of my seat, Rita.
That's really what this chapter of the book is all about. I firmly believe that Article 5 holds the only practical solution. I'm talking about Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Since the dysfunction of our federal government is the result of the perversion of constitutional language, the logical solution is to overturn those bad precedents through explicit constitutional amendments that clarify the true meaning of the language that has been distorted. So imagine, if you will, our Congress being limited in clear, modern language to using its taxing and spending power solely for performing its specifically listed duties under Article 1 of the Constitution. Imagine a Congress whose commerce power is specifically limited, as it was originally meant to be, to regulating the interstate transfer of goods. What we would have, Dean, is a leaner, more efficient federal government, a drastically reduced federal bureaucracy, and a return of most policymaking functions to the state and local governments, which are far more accountable to the people. What we would have, in short, if you think about it, is the restoration of federalism and the rule of law.
Well, I don't have much hope, Rita, that Congress will propose this kind of constitutional amendment itself. In fact, it reminds me of what one of our state legislators said, that any expectation of Congress cutting back on its own money and on its own power is as unlikely as finding a self-butchering hog. It ain't gonna happen. But tell us about the process in Article 5 by which the states can join forces to propose constitutional amendments. Sounds like a revolution of the state.
Yeah, well, I will be happy to explain it, but before I get too far, I want to just encourage our listeners to visit conventionofstates.com. You can get all the details there, the answers to your questions. There are short videos you can watch if you prefer to learn in that way. But in a nutshell, the other way, you mentioned the first way of proposing amendments, and that's to let Congress do it. You also mentioned Congress is unlikely to ever limit its own power. After all, it's made up of human beings. But in a nutshell, Dean, the other way to propose constitutional amendments is that Article 5 allows the states to propose amendments if 34 states, that's two-thirds of the states, agree that they should meet to consider amendments on a certain topic. This allows the states to go around the federal government to achieve constitutional amendments that check and balance Washington, including the federal courts. So if 34 state legislatures, the governors are not involved, it's just the state legislatures, 34 of them pass resolutions applying for a convention to propose amendments on a certain topic, then Congress is required to set a date and time for the initial meeting and let them do their thing.
Well, Rita, I know the organization you work with, Convention of States Project, has already passed that resolution in 15 states so far. But how does this resolution define the topic or agenda for an Article 5 convention?
That's a good question. And it's important for people to know that it would be a limited agenda. Under our resolution, the convention would only be able to propose constitutional amendments that do three things. One, impose fiscal restraints on Washington, limit its spending, require a balanced budget, that sort of thing. Number two, limit federal power and jurisdiction. Get Washington, D.C. out of the business that rightfully belongs to the states and the people. And number three, to set term limits for federal officials, which could include judges, by the way.
Well, Rita, I'm impressed with that. Fiscal restraints, for example, we're already over $22 trillion in our national debt, $68,000 for every U.S. citizen. I think that's one of the biggest ones you have here. Limiting its power and jurisdiction, when we left federal government move into our schools, we lost local control and authority. That's very serious. And that set term limits, I heard a new congressman talk about what most surprised him in Congress was that the apathy among the long-term members, all they're interested in is maintaining power and winning the next election. So let's assume you eventually pass this resolution in the required 34 states. What happens after that?
At that point, Congress is required to set a date and location for the initial meeting. State legislatures, again, the states drive this process. The state legislatures select the individuals who will represent them at the convention. And a state legislature can send as many individuals as they want, but at the convention, by universal historical precedent, every state only gets one vote.
So once they get to the convention, what happens?
Well, that's when they put their heads together to hash out the wording for specific amendment proposals that accomplish the objectives stated in the 34 state resolutions. If you're familiar with the state legislative process, it's kind of like that. It's kind of like a committee meeting where they get together and decide, how do we word this to accomplish the goals? Again, in the case of the Convention of States project, those would have to be proposals that impose fiscal restraints, limit federal power and jurisdiction, and set term limits.
And all they can do is propose those as amendments, right? They can't actually adopt them, so they go into force.
Absolutely. That's correct. Any proposals that are supported by a majority of the states at the convention and are within the scope of that topic, limiting federal power, fiscal restraints, term limits, any that are supported by the majority of the states then go back to the states for ratification. And only amendments that are ratified by 3/4 of the states, so that's 38 states, become part of the Constitution. That's a really high bar.
It's a high bar, Rita, and I know you've spent a lot of time on this, but I know a lot of people, including myself, still have maybe some reservations about it. So let me just pitch you some of those more common questions. First of all, don't we just need to obey the Constitution we already have? If we pass some amendments, they're going to ignore those just like they have the current Constitution. So why do we need to change it?
Well, that's a fair question, Dean. And the answer really goes back to our discussion a little earlier about what the problem is. If the Constitution were faithfully interpreted and applied according to the meaning of the words when they were written, I think we'd be in pretty good shape today. Now, I know that people like to say, well, federal officials just don't obey the Constitution. But the technical truth is really more nuanced than that. Congress isn't so much an unruly, defiant toddler as it is a smart, sneaky teenager with a horde of well-trained lawyers making creative arguments that it actually is obeying the Constitution. That's what it will tell you. So the problem is not really about federal officials ignoring the Constitution. It's more about how they lawyer around its limitations. Just look back on the individual mandate issue with the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court found a creative way to uphold an unconstitutional penalty by classifying it as a tax. And the reason it was okay as a tax was because the General Welfare Clause in Article 1 is broad and vague enough that today courts interpret it as basically letting Congress tax the people for anything it thinks is a good idea. Now, the trouble is, all this twisting and stretching of constitutional language in the name of interpretation has brought us to the point we are at today, where a simple reading of your pocket constitution doesn't actually tell you anymore what the national government does or doesn't do. You have to read thousands of pages of court interpretations to know that. And what that tells us, Dean, is that we're not really living under the rule of law anymore. We're living under the rule of judges. So what can the nation do about decades and decades of this kind of stretching and twisting of language that has broadened federal power? Well, the states can use their Article 5 authority to propose constitutional amendments that clarify what has been muddied. Amendments have been used for this purpose before and have been extremely effective.
Well, as you say, Rita, they've been used to overturn bad court decisions in the past, too, haven't they?
Absolutely. Look at the 11th Amendment. It's not one that most people are familiar with, but it was proposed by Congress and ratified by the states specifically to reverse a wrong Supreme Court decision. That was Chisholm versus Georgia, that had given the federal courts more jurisdiction than they should have had. And that was it. The problem was corrected because the amendment made a needed clarification. A constitutional amendment was the appropriate constitutional way to correct that issue. What we have today is decades of federal overreach that has been sustained by the federal courts, and it won't be corrected through an amendment that Congress proposes because Congress loves having that extra power. So the only way to correct the damage done to the integrity of constitutional language is for the states to use their power and do it definitively by proposing amendments through Article 5.
Well, Rita, I know a number of people, too, are afraid that this will become a runaway convention. They believe that what happened in 1787 was an example of a runaway convention. So what's going to stop these delegates from just proposing other amendments in what we call a runaway convention? What about that?
Well, the runaway of 1787 is a common misconception. It's absolutely false that it was a runaway convention. George Washington, James Madison, and the others did not go rogue. They were sent there by their states, not by the Confederation Congress. And if you read the instructions given to them by their states, you can see that they did not violate the public trust. And I would refer everyone to a great law review article that Michael Ferris wrote. It was published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy just a couple years ago. But the other important thing to understand is that a convention of the states under Article 5 is not at liberty to draft a whole new constitution. Its power comes from the current Constitution, and that power is, again, only to propose amendments. And finally, the states are the ones given the power to trigger the convention under Article 5, so they are therefore empowered to limit its agenda however they want to.
Okay, but Rita, another question. The details of this are really not spelled out in Article 5, so how do we know it couldn't happen?
That's a good question, too. We know it because we have a very rich history of dozens of interstate conventions, around 40, and there has never been a runaway convention. The states have always defined and limited the purpose for their meetings. The voting has always been done on a one-state, one-vote basis, and there is no record of a single interstate convention exceeding its authority. There's a new book out by Rob Nadelson called The Law of Article 5, and it's a great read if you want more details about this. It's also important to understand the basic principles of agency law come into play here. The commissioners chosen to represent their state act as legal agents of the state legislatures who sent them and instruct them through written commissions. They don't just get to do whatever they want.
Well, Rita, that's very helpful, but why are you personally so involved and so passionate about this effort?
Dean, I am so troubled by the extent to which our federal government continues to erode the rule of law that's set forth in our Constitution. I want to see the balance of power corrected. I want to see policy decisions made closer to home where people have more access and input to them. At this point in our history, the Article 5 convention process is the only way I know to make things right again with our government. Our state legislatures have a logical constitutional process available to clarify what has been muddied in the Constitution. That's why they were given this Article 5 power, and it's time for them to use it.
Well, thank you, Rita. It's a big problem. It's a problem of David and Goliath. And just tell us how we can get a copy of your book.
Well, it's now available from Blessings Christian Bookstore, located at 313 Neff Avenue here in Harrisonburg. Blessings is a sponsor of this program, so I encourage local folks to get it. You can also order it online at Amazon. Thanks again to our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our good friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thank you all for listening and also for your encouragement and financial support. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg 22803. I'm Rita Peters with Dean Welty and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.